are a really, really good friend of our friend of ours. And I got to tell you something. He is putting together probably one of the great wrestling promotions. If you're a diehard and you know, hardcore enthusiast, former ECW World Champion Tommy Dreamer. Tommy, thanks for coming on tonight for a few minutes. We really appreciate it. How are you tonight?
Not bad. Thank you for having me. What the heck are we talking about Derrick Rose and his bad knees for? Who cares? It's New York. It's Ranger. It's Hockey Town. Come on. Who cares about what else is going on? It's all Ranger and House Hardcore. That's the only thing you're talking about.
So what you're saying is you're a Ranger fan.
If it wasn't for the New York Rangers, I would probably have never have discovered professional wrestling. My father was a season ticket holder, and the game was snowed out on Channel 9 from the Canadians versus the Rangers, and instead they showed wrestling from Madison Square Garden. And, you know, when you're a young kid, you watch whatever your father is watching on television. And I remember going insane watching Bob Backlund versus a wrestler named Bulldog Brower. And I've been hooked ever since. Before I saw that, I wanted to be third base for the New York Yankees. Growing, you know, I'm 43, growing up in the 70s, Yankees win the two World Series. I was going to replace Greg Nettles. Then I saw wrestling, and I was well on my way. And I fell off the hockey bandwagon after the first strike. And then, the second strike, I told you, I was like, hockey, you've broken my heart. But now that the Rangers are back in, I'm way on the bandwagon. I am all Rangers all the time.
Well, you know, before we jump into wrestling, Tommy, let's talk about the sports, your sports fan in you. Talk to us about your first ever sporting event. What was the first type of game you ever been to? Was it a hockey game, baseball game? What was your first game you ever went to?
My first baseball game was a Yankee game. It was actually a playoff game when they played the Royals. And shortstop Freddie Popcheck kept on throwing the ball to George Brett. And then when they would finish their warm-ups, they would throw the ball to the dugout, and I stood there with my glove, and we had second row, and then all of a sudden, here comes the ball. It skips up. Boom. Tommy Dreamer caught his first ever, it wasn't really a foul ball, but I caught my first ever ball, and it was a great time. You know, I have so many memories of, you know, the original Yankee Stadium, and I am a huge sports fan. I actually just got back from St. Louis. I went to the Cardinals game on Thursday, and I have four more stadiums to go to, and I've been to every baseball stadium. I'm going to the Seattle Mariners game against the Yankees on Thursday, and I'm also going to hit Texas, and then I'll just have Coors Field, and Arizona as my last two to go. But and then I went to a Mets game. I got my first ever autographs from Manny Mota and Dusty Baker. Probably 2 weeks later, I've been to a bunch of Ranger games. Again, I followed the season. At one point, season Giants, Knicks, and Rangers. We still get the Giants tickets. Because of we give them to my uncle. I guess it's kind of inherited into the. They still come to my house. I guess they haven't figured out that my father passed away about 5 years ago. But we still get the invites, and you know, my uncle pays for them, and he distributes them, and you know, huge sports fan.
Having the name value that you do, has there been anybody that you've ever wanted to meet that you sort of felt like a little starstruck?
A couple times. It's funny. The first time I met Mr. T, he just showed up at a WWE event, and he was the first person I ever handed my cell phone to and said, "Can you leave a message for my friend?" Because he was a former wrestler, and we were just huge Mr. T fans. To tell you how much of a fan I was, number one, I was at first WrestleMania, and so I paid to see Mr. T wrestle. That's how much of a fan I was. I took a girlfriend on Valentine's Day to see the movie No Holds Barred when I was 17 years old. So how is that for a wrestling fan?
That's classic. That is classic.
And I was I hosted Ozfest 2 years in a row out in New Jersey. Meeting Ozzy was really, really cool. And, I've had a blessed career and a blessed, you know, meeting. You know, celebrities are celebrities. I have a whole... I'm staring at it right now, my own little, you know, when you get married, you're not allowed to have a lot of stuff. It's all for your kids. And I'm allowed a wall for my career in my own house. And I have
how big is the wall?
That's a regular size wall. Maybe 14, 14 feet across. And I have all my autographs of people that I've met, as well as my baseball autographs. I have a 500 home run collection if anyone ever wants to donate to. I'm looking for that Babe Ruth ball, but I don't want to pay for it. But, I mean, I got, you know, Lawrence Taylor, that Bam Bam Bigelow. I got, met him. I got Joe Theismann. I got Brett Favre. I have a lot of guys, Michael Strahan, all wrestling fans, a LeBron James jersey that I wrestled in that he gave me. So, I mean, again, a big sports enthusiast, always was. I was a baseball card collector. You know, you name it, I love it. You know, sports are gives us all something to talk about, right, guys?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. So, hey, Tommy, has there ever been a celebrity that you met that after meeting him you were surprised at how big of a wrestling fan they were?
No, not really. I'm good friends with A.J. Pierzynski, the catcher of Boston Red Sox now, and he would have given it all up to become a professional wrestler, and he loves wrestling.
I can see
that
the way
he plays. Yeah, he's awesome, man. He loves wrestling, but I mean, again, there's so many athletes out there that are just, you know, huge fans, and Sean Merriman, from the Chargers, we did something together in San Diego. He's now actually in the WWE developmental system doing stuff. And, you know, I think he's learning to be a professional wrestler. So it's cool because, I mean, to me, wrestling has transcended the ages. You can go, and especially like my shows or even WWE, you see, you know, grandparents sit with their grandchildren and, you know, parents sitting with their children. And, you know, it's, I think with wrestling, a lot of people, they start watching it when they're young. They start getting involved with school and sports and their girls and boys, and they break away from it. But eventually they will always come back to it, or they just won't look at it again. Me, I've never grown up, and I've had, you know, I'm still a fan. I watch all products and just going out there and, you know, now kind of doing my own stuff is just kind of giving back to the business that has blessed me for so long.
And you have such a storied career in wrestling. Can you talk about the early days of ECW? Just how the concept through time ended up sort of changing and how you changed with it?
You look at the business back then. It was garnered. Business was at a real low point, and there was a lot of guys, like, you know, who had gimmicks. There was a trash man. You know, there was a Doink the Clown. It was garnered really towards kids, and it had lost, you know, from what it had, the boom of, you know, the 80s. And, you know, there was WCW, there was WWE, and I was a really good-looking, I guess, Guido type of kid. I was at Jersey Shore before the Jersey Shore was cool, and, you know, I was a pretty boy. And went to ECW, showed up, and Paul Heyman was in control, and he liked how I wrestled, all this stuff, but, you know, the fans weren't accepting me because of my unbelievably good looks. And, yes, I said that with sarcasm, but I was. I mean, come on, you follow me on Twitter, you see all the pictures I post. I was a topless waiter at an all-male review. That's how hot-looking I used to be until I became this hideous hardcore freak. So then our niche to try to, you know, we didn't have national television. Our niche was violence. Our niche was, you know, a lot of, you know, Paul Heyman's vision early on, and just kind of be like, you know, what wrestling was in his mind, you know, and that was our niche. And we had guys like Sabu who were, you know, at the time, no one had ever seen anything that this guy could do. And we had, you know, the tables and all the crazy stuff. We had Terry Funk, Mick Foley, and, you know, myself, I did a famous or infamous caning angle, where, you know, at the time there was a U.S. citizen who committed a crime in Singapore, and he was going to get 10 lashes, and it became national news. So then Paul came up with, what if we had a match where, you know, the loser of the match gets caned, and, you know, just to try to catch that national attention, and that was me. And, you know, I got caned actually 11 times by the Sandman, and, you know, I went from this good-looking kid to this hardcore guy, which is funny, though. I actually got more girls looking more hardcore than I did as my – and I always tell the wrestler Robbie E. of Impact, I was like, dude, man, grow a goatee and stop with this, all this your body and just go out there and wrestle. Because, but I was fortunate to have someone like Terry Funk, who was like, Tommy, people will like you because you're you and you're a likable person. Maybe grow a goatee to make you look tougher. Now I have a goatee to hide my double chin. But, you know, it made me the man that I am today. And, you know, I went from the pretty boy to the innovator of violence, the heart and soul of ECW. And I got a test to Paul Heyman believing in me and Taz basically going to Paul and saying, hey, this kid is tough. Trust me. I mean, Taz and I, you know, wrestled all over the place, and he would come up with all these suplexes. Like, I think I want to suplex a guy upside down by his head. Dreamer, come here. And I would just take it and get up, and that's kind of how it, you know, that's how my career kind of morphed. I was basically everybody's crash test.
How does that work, though? Wait, how does that work? Okay, well, we want to try something. Let's bring Tommy over here.
Exactly. That's how it was.
Oh, God.
I will tell you this. When I worked, and to tell you, I guess, my crash test dummy, this is a true story, and Edge and Mick Foley always could laugh over it. When they had their big WrestleMania hardcore match in Chicago, they wanted to do I don't want to say a rehearsal, but just they would, a lot of times they have to do tests, especially when you're dealing with fire and you have to deal with fire marshals and stuff. And it happened then when I wrote ECW One Night Stand in Hammerstein Ballroom. I'm having the production meeting with Vince McMahon right there to get the call over the walkie-talkies. Hey, we got to do a fire test. So in my suit, I say, guys, hold on. We're having a meeting. Every powers to be that's in the meeting. In my suit, run down to the second floor, get in the ring. They take the lighter fluid, light the table on fire, and I had to go through the flaming table in a suit, and they're like, oh, that's it? Yeah, okay, that's it. Boom, I had to run back up and finish the meeting. back to the Mick Foley thing. So, you know, I was working in behind the scenes in WWE, and, you know, Vince McMahon comes up to me and says, Tommy, I want you to help out, you know, with this match. You know, this is the hardcore stuff. This is what you're all about. And I'm like, wow, this is awesome. Vince wants me to do this. Blah, blah, blah. So I worked a 12-hour workday in the green room. WrestleMania is like, you know, the WrestleMania green room is, it's the war room, man. It's the draft. It's where all the action goes on. And when you're working there, the people behind the scenes don't get enough credit for how hard they work. So after I finished a 12-hour day, they had a ring set up in the grand ballroom of the hotel. And so then why did they want Tommy Dreamer there? They didn't want to risk their two stars, Edge and Mick Foley, getting hurt. They light a fire, and Tommy Dreamer has to go through a flaming table after a 12-hour workday.
Oh, God.
So that's how that works. I was the crash test dummy for everything.
Hey, Tommy, that's funny you brought up Mick Foley, because I remember watching something a little bit ago on Mick, and at the end of it he kind of talks about how he didn't really realize it in the beginning of his career, but all the bumps he took and the risks he took have kind of caught up to him now, you know, aches and pains and problems, and he said stairs are not his best friend anymore. You kind of had this similar type of style. Is that something you worried about while you were doing it? And health-wise, how are you holding up after all those bumps you took, especially early on when you were with ECW?
One thing, and I'm not saying that this is a big – I feel it's a big key. I always worked out. I was a huge gym rat, so I was always, you know, building up the muscle, breaking it down. Mick Foley was never a gym guy, if you couldn't tell by his physique. It stinks today because I train really, really hard to look like this. I still do an hour of cardio. I work out every day. there's a lot of guys who, you know, took a lot of punishment in their careers, and I've taken the same big bumps from the top of steel cages, all that stuff. I'll give Mick more credit because he did it on the biggest cage of them all. I took a choke slam from the top of a steel cage in Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania once, and there was probably, you know, 700 people. I broke my neck. I broke my back. I've never had a surgery. I feel great. I get up every morning. I do cardio. The only time I feel pain is really when I fly. I don't know if it's because of the compression of the airplane or just my butt is way too big to sit in those seats now, but I live pretty much pain-free. I actually met a guy on Twitter who's a doctor, a chiropractor, and he gave me this invention. It's called Low Back Tracks. I've given it to, I suggested it to Joey Styles. I suggested it to an author friend of mine, Jeff Perlman, who has a number one bestseller book out there about the Lakers right now. And it has saved, it has in not only improved my quality of life, but I think it's extended my career. Joey Styles was looking at back surgery and couldn't sit at his work. He works in WWE. He has to stand. Now he can sit. He can fly in a plane. I gave it to Mick Foley. I don't know if Mick uses it. Mick's also, and I'm not, you know, bashing Mick at all, Mick's also gained a lot of weight. He needs to, I've seen him when really diet and train. I know it's hard because he's doing this comedy thing. And I recently saw Mick, and I hated how slow I saw him walking because Mick is a great friend, and Mick is another guy who's really, really helped me. But, I mean, honestly, I do. I feel some mornings I get are a little rougher than others, or if I sit in a car way too long. But I do. I feel good for the amount of abuse that I've done to myself, which I'm just blessed. You know, as soon as I finish this interview, I'm going to go to the gym. I cannot look the way I used to look. I have two torn pecs, a torn shoulder, a torn bicep. Again, I've never had a surgery, but I do it more for, what's his name, Jack O'Lane used to swim, you know, every day a certain amount of miles, or run every day a certain amount of miles. So mm-hmm. people be like, oh, he's 80. But to me, if you do it every single day, it's just part of your norm. So I'm hoping that'll, the Jack O'Lane system will stick with me that way, or else I'll be a wreck. Because once I go for one surgery, I'm getting them all. I'm going to get liposuction, hair implants. I may get breast implants just so I can touch myself. Who the heck knows what I'm going to do?
Tommy, I got to ask this question too, because there's so much made of the, you know, the Beyond the Mat DVD and just the, you know, the reputation that ECW had. Can you take us behind the scenes of ECW and the creative, how you guys were able to, you know, the action spoke for itself, but the actual creative on how the stories were working back then. Can you take us behind the scenes on how it was?
Sure. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Half of this stuff that you saw that we did was illegal in the sense of, you know, Sandman, Enter the Sandman, Tommy Dreamer, Man in the Box, all the music that we used, it was all illegal. We just put it out there. A big part of why the WWE Network, you know, people are like, why do they edit all that stuff? It's a lot because of the music. Paul would always be, my father's a lawyer, you know, send me the stuff. Towards the end when we hit national television, we were getting let a cease and desist by Sony Records every single week. Storylines, early stages of ECW was all Paul. The best part about Paul Heyman, he gave us creative freedom and input. The best part about the locker room, it was no anybody working for them. We had some guys like that, but at the end of the day, they all got the bigger picture. With like myself and Raven, you know, a famous feud that I had with him, you know, the early stages, and Paul was, and I say it to a lot of guys too, when I worked in WWE, or especially, you know, if I'm helping out in TNA, or even when I go on the indies, man, there's so much talent out there on the indies of guys. I was blessed because I walked back from a locker room and I had Paul Heyman. I had Terry Funk. I had Kevin Sullivan. I had Mick Foley all helping me when I came back through that curtain. There aren't a lot of veterans out there that either A, care, or B, watch the other guys' matches. When, you know, Paul basically held our hands, and I tell guys, you have no clue how many times I failed, or the Sandman failed, or Taz, or Sabu, or Rob Van Dam, or the Dudley Boys, and Paul would pick us up, dust us off, and give us another opportunity. If he kept on failing, guess what? He can help you out. But he believed in a lot of us. We also then had creative input. I remember, you know, Paul and I would, we started then traveling together because he lives in Scarsdale. I lived in Yonkers. We would just drive together. And, you know, then at 22, 23 years old, he took me into the studio. And at that time, you know, if you were a wrestler, you were just a wrestler. You weren't allowed behind the scenes. Paul let me come behind the scenes, and he taught me how to edit a television show. He taught me how to, you know, this is why I'm booking this. This is where I want to go, you know, for this show. And then, you know, he would let me book shows with him or help, you know, with editing. So, and like well, me and Raven, you know, we would start, by that time, we, you know, we would watch, he would like stuff, he would suggest stuff. And then it was a lot of me and Raven, or a lot of, you know, me coming up with stuff, or a lot of, you know, Raven coming up with stuff. So we were allowed, Russell were allowed to disagree, and Paul would let you listen. And if he liked something that was better, he would change it. If he didn't agree with it, he would stick to his guns, which is great. I mean, honestly, I don't know, you know, if you're running a major sports franchise, I don't know how many, you know, unless you're like the top, top guy, they, you know, but Paul would take, listen to other people. So, I mean, that was the early stages of the original ECW, of we all, majority of us, all had a say, and we could, you know, well, what if we could do this, or this, and it was all to help improve the business for return and repeat business in that same venue. And again, once guys, and I remember when I pile drove Beulah, and I hit my pose, I was accepted into the people, and I jumped over the guardrail, and I hit my pose in the crowd, and we were chanting ECW, ECW. Paul played that every single, that was on the opening of the show every single week. Still, they'll show it on DVDs, all this stuff, this bloody Tommy Dreamer yelling, chanting, and all this carnage in the ring. But he was like, you're over, you're accepted. Once you get over and accepted, the people will never, you'll never lose that unless you turn on those people. And I never have. Another thing, and I've said this so many times with Paul, he never lied to his audience. At the time, I mean, there's times Sabu, who was our biggest star, Sabu was the John Cena of ECW at one point, and he took a booking in New Japan Pro Wrestling, and our biggest star no-showed our show, and Paul basically went out there, and the most beloved, you know, wrestler in the company, Paul went out and told them the truth, and he said he chose more money and another booking over you people. And I remember it like it was an instant turn, and it went from, like, we love Sabu to F you, Sabu. And, you know, that was key, and I think why after 13, 14 years, people are still talking about ECW. You know, with the WWE Network, they post the most watched stuff. They recently just had, we were like the eighth most watched show. I was, you know, I don't know what episode I don't have of WWE Network, because if I did, I would never leave my home. But, no, it's true. I mean, I'm weird, and I will watch wrestling, at least one wrestling match a day, or if I see like an obscure reference, I will go and, like, look that person up, and I don't sleep much, especially now that I'm running shows. I haven't been sleeping. And then, you know, go on YouTube, and then next thing I know, oh, look, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm not watching porn. I'm watching wrestling. What is wrong with me? I should get up and take my kids to school in 3 hours.
Tommy, this is a question I think that a lot of people probably would really love to know the answer to. Towards the end of ECW, what point were you guys sort of told what was going on, that the company was closing down? And what was the reaction when you turned on Monday Night Raw and saw Paul Heyman sitting there doing commentary?
Ooh, touchy subject. We never were. One day, there's been a lot of documentaries. ECW never had to go out of business. There was a point where I had pretty much saved the company. There was a lot going on, and Paul kind of screwed me over. And it didn't have to go down like that, but he didn't want to really sell it to, you know, I was going to be the boss. He was then going to, you know, they didn't trust Paul. That was that. Nobody ever knew. he called me the Sunday before he went and was just like, hey, I'm going to show up there. And I was just like, ugh. And then, you know, years later to find out that he was in Vince's pocket the whole time, it was a hard pill to swallow. But to me, everything happens for a reason. If, you know, why I guess I didn't beat him up or kill him was because if it wasn't for ECW, I wouldn't have gotten married and had two beautiful children, and because I was married to the business. And, you know, I guess it's just, you know, everything happens for a reason. And, you know, so it is what it is. And, you know, Paul had a lot of people don't like Paul Heyman for a lot of different reasons. I have no issues with him. I don't really speak to him. I wish we were at times closer, but we, he's out there doing his thing. I'm out there doing my thing. I have no animosity towards him. Again, because everything happens for a reason. There are, you got to let things go, and you got to let, you know, people just do their own thing. It was funny, me and Bubba Bully Ray were traveling the other day, and we were down in TNA and something, and he's like, could you believe out of all those people, Paul Heyman's, you know, he's been in WWE for the last 2 years working the main event of WrestleMania, and he just got on the phone, and he cut a quick promo, cursed Lee promo at him. He's like, all right, I'll see you later, call it back, you know, but that's the kind of relationship we all have. So.
That's awesome.
It's funny you brought up getting lost in the WWE Network, and I've actually done that countless times, so I can feel where you're coming from on that problem. But one of the things I did is I wanted to go back and watch pay-per-views that I may have forgotten about being young or whatever, and I went to the one that you guys crashed in Philly. I think it was Mind Games in 96 or whatever, and I think the first time I noticed it was a Caribbean strap match, I think it was Bradshaw and Savio Vega, which I didn't like those matches, and I kind of enjoyed that the Sandman kind of got involved, and all of a sudden starts smashing his beer can, and I looked over to the right, and there you are, just arms on the chair on the other side, just looking over, and I think, was it Paul that grabbed him away and whatnot? Well, kind of go through that a little bit, because I know Taz, I think, showed up later in the pay-per-view as well.
Right, when we did
and actually got over the...
Yeah, when we did all that, we were trying to promote ECW. They were coming in. It was the shows before it with Mick Foley, and HBK had a wild, wild match, and they were chanting ECW. We were trying to get like national exposure for ECW, and so we basically had this arrangement. Again, knowing what I know now, it's stupid that. We went there like we were really invading the show. The only people that knew, they didn't tell. It was a deal between Paul and Vince. When I spoke to Bradshaw, because I'm great friends with John now, and he was just like, he goes, when I saw that, the only person they told was Savio Vega. Even Dutch Mantel said, Zeb Akiah, or whatever he is, Uncle Zeb, and now, nobody knew. And when they had that little run-in with all the agents, I remember Jerry Briscoe, who's a great friend of mine and a real, shooter, he was like, you son of a bitch, just jump over this rail. I swear to God, I'll kill you. And I'm like, whoa, I thought these guys knew what was going on. And I've heard from, guys who were, in the back, there were certain people that wanted to come out and really fight us. And we were ready. I said, when all that stuff was going on, I was like, there's no way that WWE would allow us to really invade. So I kind of like knew that, but we had that show when we did it in Philly. It was just me and, but we all met in the parking lot. We got guys tickets and we had reinforcements. We had the eliminators. We had our own hit squad in case a real fight broke out. Because when you're dealing with stuff like that, back then it was a much more tumultuous time. And that's also Paulie exaggerating the truth. That's a nice way to put it. And, not telling us everything that's going on. And Paul was just straight up. He's just like, only a handful of people know. We got to be ready. And, I mean, it was almost a real fight back then. But it was, you know, it was, I was just like, there's no, because again, there's no way, I guarantee you, if a bunch of the New York Met players showed up behind first base and started doing stuff, they would just be escorted out, you know. But it is what it is. You know, it was, again, it was a great time. WWE was getting their butt kicked by WCW. They were just looking for anything to happen. And that's kind of why, you know, it was a win-win for both parties.
Tommy, do you see any type of wrestling promotion, whether it's TNA, House of Hardcore, ROH, do you see any of those types of organizations, the smaller organizations, willing to take that type of risk to try and get more recognition, more notoriety in today's wrestling world? Can that type of thing work now?
I think Ring of Honor has definitely stepped up with their, I guess, inner promotion with New Japan Wrestling. And I cannot judge anything about New Japan, about Ring of Honor, because I don't see it. I don't get the television product. But I'm looking at, you know, they go to the Hammerstein Ballroom and they're selling it out. And I know a lot of the athletes that they use, and I'm sure that they're, you know, they're tearing it up. I think they have an opportunity to, you know, you need to be different. You need to be an alternative. Myself, this is hard. This is my life savings that I'm putting into this, and so far it's paid off for me. This is how I view professional wrestling. I do not have, you know, Dixie Carter's family's money. I do not have, you know, I'm not a publicly traded company. Today alone, I spent $2,600 on hotel rooms. And, you know, if I did, you got to do with math, if I was selling tickets at $10 a pop, I got to sell a certain amount of money just to cover guys' hotel rooms. And then it's what I got to pay the guys. Then it's what I have to, you know, pay for their flights. It's very, very expensive for me and, you know, for TNA too, for WWE. WWE is the top. TNA has the resources. TNA has the talent. I think TNA's talent base is amazing. I think TNA needs to do things different. And I love TNA. I help out behind the scenes in TNA, and they have a really, really good roster. If to me, I look at everything from an athletic background. If you're on offense and people are scoring all over you, you got to change your defense. And if you're on defense and they're, you know, doing stuff, then you got to change your defense. So I just think you need to be different. I think the business is primed, and no one should ever say, I'm going to take down the WWE. Because one, why would you want to? And two, their infrastructure is so, so strong. The only way WWE would go down is if they destroyed them themselves, and that's not going to happen. To me, you need difference. You know, when I grew up, there was so many different wrestling promotions. There was so many different places to work. And if you think about it, you know, there was a time in the world where there's probably 20 companies, and every company was wrestling 7 nights a week. Think about that. You know, now there's just really 2 to 3 companies, but I mean, really 2 that work, you know, WWE tours all the time there. But I mean, you turn around, you look on television, they're on television every second. But it's a lot of the same players. To me, you want different players. A lot of people, like with the WWE Network, everyone's been praising NXT. You know why? Because it's different. If you have something different, people will watch it. I'm a huge sports fan. I guess the greatest rivalry is the Yankees versus the Red Sox. I would not want to watch 162-game season of the Yankees versus the Red Sox.
No, you definitely can't. Now, Tommy, a quick question here, too. Since you work behind the scenes with WWE, you work behind the scenes with ECW, and you work behind the scenes with TNA, Vince and Paul were both very, I guess, hands-on. You know, Vince works, you know, talks with his talent. He has a team that works with talent. And TNA, it's owned by Dixie and the family there. It doesn't seem, I don't, we're not behind the scenes, so we don't know how hands-on Dixie is with the talent. Can you talk about the difference about ownership and dealing with the talent compared to the three organizations, ECW, TNA, and WWE?
Paul gave me, taught me everything, gave me creative freedom. Vince, when I'm dealing with him one-on-one, I've had some amazing meetings. Vince gave me the opportunity to, Tommy, I mean, I wrote ECW One Night Stand, 2005. They didn't even want Paul on it. I had to fight for Paul to get on it. Vince gave me that opportunity, handed me the ball, I scored. Dixie Carter gave me the opportunity to do Hardcore Justice. It did great business for them. Dixie is, well, she's the hottest boss that I've had. and I could not say, I have every, you know, everyone talks about, you know, there's a lot of negativity towards Dixie Carter. Dixie Carter basically saved TNA wrestling. It was going out of business. She came in with her parents, you know, with Jeff Jarrett. I guess, you know, she knew him, came in and saved it. She doesn't get enough credit for doing that, and the company's been around for a long time. She does work very, very hard, and she's earned, she doesn't get credit for it, but she's earned my respect for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, honestly, I mean, I can talk with her. She's a woman in a man's orientated business, as well as she's a mother, she's a wife, and she's also running, you know, a company. And, you know, trust me, it is hard to do. I've been up, I had an hour of sleep last night, and today I booked everybody's hotels. I'm still trying to see how am I going to get, I got to pick everybody up at the airport. I then got to take them to the hotel, let them chill for a little bit. Then I got to take, you know, them up to the cars. I'm trying to arrange rides for guys. Then from there, I got to put together the show, as well as then from there, you know, I have a national television TV show coming there to film some stuff on Friday night. I've been dealing with them. I've been dealing with emails. I've been doing promotions for these events. I put together payroll. I also had to work out. I had to take my kids to school. I had to sit with my family and have some dinner. People have no clue how hard it is, one, when you're the boss, and two, when you're trying to put something together. And, you know, for me, I need more people to help me, but guess what? I can't afford to pay people that. I hope one day I could. I wish I had Vince McMahon's office. I wish I had Dixie Carter's office. I wish I had the help, but I don't. Hopefully one day I could be. And a lot of people want to cast stones at, you know, Vince McMahon or, you know, when Vince McMahon lost, you know, $360 million in one day and their stock plummeted, everyone was going crazy, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, guess what? He was a billionaire. He lost $360 million, but let's do the math. That means he still has $650 million. With I play Powerball today just to win, like, $200 million. So, you know, that's okay.
Yeah. If I lost $30, I'd have a hard time, like, showing my face the next day, so.
Yeah.
You know, again, it is hard, but to me, it's the most rewarding business in the world, and it's also, it's something that I've loved since I'm a kid. These shows have been profitable to me. At the end of the day, I get to see my hard work being paid off, and, you know, this is Friday's show in Poughkeepsie will be my fourth show. Saturday's show will be my fifth show, and then next week I have a ridiculous show in California, and you know,
I saw the lineup
the
for the one in California. The lineup in California, that's crazy. I saw that one. I was like, wow.
Well, that has a lot to do with the convention. I wouldn't pay half those people to be there. You know, that's part of a convention. That's a whole other side deal with a trading card company and all this stuff. But you know, I do feel everyone has something to offer, and if you're a wrestling fan, hey, you're going to come out there and you're going to see a crazy amount of talent. And my show's bottom line is you have to do it in the ring, and, you know, and it's also, like I say, no politics, no BS, just wrestling. and they're going to get that at my shows, and they're going to, I want people to say, I'm also, you know, I'm a father of twins. We went and saw Maleficent this weekend, and it was an okay movie, but then I looked around, I was like, I spent close to $75 to go see an hour and a half movie. I was like, that is horrible. And I know the prices of a lot of these events, and I didn't make my stuff very, very expensive. I know my break-even. I want people to just walk away and be like, wow, I got the most bang for my buck because I'm trying for repeat business. And so far it's paid off.
Tommy, I think you mentioned a lot of stuff about TNA, and a lot of people have wondered, like, oh, the WWE is a bad product because there's no one to push them, like they had WCW, to push them to be creative, and they're getting lazy with their writing. And, you know, some of that may be true, some of it maybe not, but everyone's looked at TNA as having the resources and the talent, like you mentioned, to be that kind of push to the WWE, but it hasn't, I don't know if it hasn't happened or hasn't happened to what some people expected it to. Working behind the scenes with it, what is something that you see that maybe if they tweaked something, they could get that push that everyone is expecting from TNA that they've been expecting for, you know, for some time now?
I mean, a lot of times, it's a question for me to answer because, one, I was there for a year. I had a great time. I decided, you know, not to re-sign. Recently, I've been there. They're trying to make changes. They have been nothing but good to me. I look at stuff like with me, I always want accountability. And again, if you look at stuff from an athletic background, if you're putting people in charge and, you know, you're not getting the goal that you want, those people need to be replaced. I think they have a lot of good people. They have an amazing staff, and they have an amazing group of wrestlers that go out there and try their hardest. Hopefully it can – I want it to change. I think the wrestling business needs it to change. I think they have a lot of – you know, and it's – but it's – they also get a lot of unfair criticism. I remember, you know, when Eric Young won the title, it's, oh, my God, they're copying Daniel Bryan. Oh, my God, they're doing this. Why? Because they both have beards. If there was anyone who was ever deserving of being a champion, was Eric Young, and as well as – he has his own television show. I recently just saw, you know, on Good Morning New York, Good Day New York, all these talk shows, you have the TNA heavyweight champion on these shows, you know, talking about his television show, talking about Impact Wrestling. That helps, you know. There's a lot more that goes into it, and, you know, the ratings have not totally dipped, and they've stayed the same or have gone up. And again, Eric Young is a likable, entertaining champion. There's nothing wrong with that. But they do get, at times, unfair criticism. And there's other times they get, you know, but you think about it, social media has changed the landscape of professional wrestling. It changed the main event of WrestleMania. It changed the plans of WrestleMania. So it's you cannot please everybody. I get a lot of, you know, positive tweets out there. I'm very active on Facebook. And, you know, but then you always get someone, hey, Dreamer, you stink. Hey, Dreamer, you suck. Hey, Dreamer, you know. And it's like, okay, I get it. You cannot please everybody. And I've seen some shows with TNA that were off the charts fabulous. I've seen, you know, their pay-per-views, their matches. Some of them were great. In-ring product, amazing. But if you have so many people that are down on something or so many people, you know, hopefully they can turn the corner. I really hope they do. They have TVs coming up in New York as well, and I think those can be very, very important to the company. Because you can make it there, you can make it anywhere, right? That's what they say in New York?
Oh, yeah.
That's what we've been told, yeah.
Tommy, talk to me about your shows this weekend. But can you let people know, A, who's on the card, where they can get tickets?
Sure.
And some of the website, you know, and then we do something on the show called Five Random Questions. But I want to talk about House of Hardcore. Talk to us who's going to be there this weekend.
Every single person who's good. myself and the Monster Abyss will be taking on Team 3D, a.k.a. the Dudley Boys, in an extreme old school war, which basically means, and again, when you look at stuff as a wrestler as opposed to looking stuff as a promoter, I had to go out and purchase tables. And I'm like, damn, tables cost $115 just to go out and break it. That is just totally taking my money and ripping it up. As a wrestler, that's awesome when a table breaks. As a promoter, I'm like, ugh, maybe the Dudleys want to use two tables tonight, not, you know, five. And then, you know, I got to go out and buy thumbtacks. I'm like, I have to go out and buy these thumbtacks, which I will probably wind up in. This is horrible. And barbed wire. Where's the local barbed wire store? We don't live in Texas. I live in New York. So these are all promoter problems. So that is one match. You have the New Japan Heavyweight Champion, the phenomenal one, AJ Styles, taking on Chris Hero. Kevin Steen from Ring of Honor will be taking on Adam Pearce. You have an amazing three-way match, which I've had at every show that I've done because the guys are so good. Petey Williams, Tony Nese versus Alex Reynolds. And it's the last time, and you talk about, you know, how I was brought up. I believe in stipulations. It's still real to me, damn it. When I did wrestled Raven, Hardcore Justice, I said that was the last time I was ever going to wrestle Raven. Promoters have asked me to do it. I've yet to do it. I won't do it. My last show that I had in Poughkeepsie, it was me and Terry Funk tag, and I said it's the last time I'm ever going to tag with Terry Funk. I use it as a promotion. To get people to come to the show, but it's also, you know, you get to see something special and you get to say, hey, I was there. That's the last time I'm going to do that match because I don't think they – I asked them specifically, can you guys top what you did last time? The last time they did, Petey Williams did a top rope Canadian Destroyer, which is basically a flipping pile driver from the top rope. I have no clue how Alex Reynolds did not die, but he's back, and if he dies at this show, it won't be good. Because death is never a good thing, but if he does it, it'll at least get me national press. I'm only kidding, but that match is phenomenal. And, I mean, I also have guys like Gangrel, the Godfather's coming in. He's just doing autographs. There's a big autograph session before, and it's, you know, it's not going to cost you, you know, hundreds of dollars. It's, you know, everyone's out there for, you know, 10 and 20 bucks to sign an autograph, take a picture. That's the, you know, father in me and, you know, not trying. I don't want to rape everyone for their money. I do not want to come in and take everybody for their money. I want people to come in and say, wow, I was entertained. I got the most bang for my buck. And next time I see that show, I'm going to be there because that's what how I was kind of taught.
The website?
Oh, houseofhardcore.net. Go on houseofhardcore.com because it is bad pornography. Houseofhardcore.net. If you go on .com, you will your spouse or your loved one will be like, "What the hell are you looking at all this porn for?" I sometimes make that mistake three times a day, but at least when my history is checked, it's like, "Oops, I accidentally went on the website, honey."
And is it, you know, they can purchase their tickets, I'm assuming, through houseofhardcore.com.
Houseofhardcore.net. You see what you just did? You just got friggin' some porn site, a whole bunch of friggin' views. And in Philly, where the birthplace of Tommy Dreamer was, we're going to go me versus the Monster Abyss in an extreme Monster's Ball. What does that mean? I have no clue. I'm extreme. He likes the Monster's Ball match. It means I'm probably going to wind up in thumbtacks and barbed wire, and so is he, and two big 40-year-old men bleeding all over the place. You'll have Kevin Steen versus AJ Styles, the New Japan Heavyweight Championship, which is going to be a wrestling clinic. You have Frankie Kazarian and Christopher Daniels, who just left TNA. Now they're jumping to Ring of Honor, and they're going to be wrestling Team 3D. I mean, you go down from top to bottom. I remember getting the old wrestling magazines, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling, and I would always look at all these fantasy matchups. This is a way to me to play fantasy booker god, and I get to put it all together, and hopefully the fans enjoy my crazy warped wrestling mind and, you know, again, go out there and just be like, wow, I saw one hell of a show.
So, and now, if people wanted to send you flowers after this weekend in the hospital, which hospital should they send them to?
Either Philadelphia. Well, it is in Philadelphia, yes. Yeah, so, send them to Philly.
All right, this is all, what we'd like to do is five random questions. We'd like to just come up with five random questions to ask our guests. It's brought to you by Uppy Custom Creations. They bring fame to your name. Get any T-shirts, hats, pens, anything with your company name on it, they will take care of it. Ask for Mike, upbecustomcreations.net. First question from me, Tommy, how did you feel the first time you saw yourself in a video game or saw an action figure of you?
Amazing. It was a great accomplishment. The best part about UCW is I could watch it rise, and you could actually see the growth of your company. And one of the better moments when you see yourself, my only sidebar to the excitement was when they told me I was going to be on the cover of the first ECW game. It was, we did this big photo shoot the night before Rob Van Dam kicked me in my eye, and I had a huge black eye doing my first ever photo shoot. I was never meant to be a model. So that's why if you ever go and look at that original ECW video game, I have a big shiner on my eye, and that was real. That wasn't makeup, but it kind of goes with the Tommy Dreamer motif. But seeing yourself having an action figure is amazing. And my kids still have them, and they call them daddy dolls. And for the longest time, they thought that every father had a daddy doll.
That's awesome. Tommy, when you look back at your ECW time, what's the if you had to pick one thing that maybe stood out above the rest, what would it be?
Nothing. Everything was always – we always topped everything we could. There was – and then the first time and I tell – you know, I work every weekend wrestling 2 to 3 times a week on different independents. And, you know, some houses are good. Some houses – well, majority are good. But, you know, the first time we wrestled, we did a television taping for ECW. We had 34 people there. And we did television with that audience, but we could watch it grow. And, you know, I was just in Chicago, and I said, hey, Chicago, you are our largest crowd ever. I mean, that place, we had thousands of people, and those were like, you could see yourself and the growth of the company where, wow, the ECW arena is, you know, it went from 34 people to it's sold out. Hey, we can't fit people in, or people are hanging out outside. I used to take half my matches outside to the street because there was a huge crowd out there. And people would still be outside so they can hear the action. How great is that?
That's awesome. you said before that you've been traveling to all the Major League Baseball stadiums. Which stadium has the best food?
Has the best food?
Yeah. Really? Okay.
So the garlic fries, yes. The new Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
It has everything. Dude, it has a butcher shop. Their sushi is awesome. Old Yankee Stadium, I ate sushi there once at the 7th inning. Game ended, and I almost pooped my pants on the Major Deegan trying to drive home. It ran through me like I think the fish was actually still alive. But New Yankee Stadium, the food is the best. I have, you know, my favorite ballpark is the Metrodome to watch baseball besides, you know, Yankee Stadium or Shea Stadium because of the memories, you know. But the Metrodome was an amazing place to watch baseball, and I was fortunate to catch it on the last weekend that the stadium was going to be in existence, and they had to win every game, and it was just an amazing crowd. And they have a great Harmon Killer Brew root beer. In Oakland, they had great garlic fries dripping in pure garlic all over my pants, and I was just wiping them all over myself, and it was just, that's, you know, there's a lot of good in St. Louis. I just went and ate at a fresh turkey carving station, and they had an amazing, you know, little setup. But again, man, then I was like, you know, I'm not a beer drinker, but I always, you know, I'm a wrestling and, you know, always look at promotions and, you know, all that stuff. Freaking $9.25 for a beer, you know, it's crazy. 5.25 for a bottle of water.
Yeah, I agree. Well, as a promoter, I'm running all those things, and you've talked about it, you know, with us, the different aspects of it. Well, what's the one thing you noticed immediately when you started doing this that you were like, man, I didn't realize they had to do this, or you know, man, as a wrestler, we never had to worry about this. I can't believe I have to worry about this now as a promoter.
Cost of insurance when you have to run an event. Specific guidelines, the BS you will get when with, you know, everyone out there thinks they're the next Vince McMahon, and they're not, and you deal with a lot of lower promoters trying to cause you problems or, and then, you know, I'm the type of guy, you cause me a problem, I confront you on it. And then there's a lot of people like, no, it's not me, blah, 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 blah. Or, you know, just the amount of money goes, you know, to advertising. You know, I have ads on Monday Night Raw, on SmackDown, on Impact, on ESPN. You know, those are, that's, you will see how much you get yourself in a hole for rent and advertising, and you haven't even done anything for the show. Everything has a price tag, as the Million Dollar Man once said. Everybody has a price, but when you're running the show, everything has a price tag.
And the final question here of the random five
questions. We only asked like two questions. Did we best food and the other one? We got like three more to go unless you cut me short.
No, we did the five. Okay. We did the video game action figure.
Okay.
He asked about the ECW memory question. I asked about the
I didn't know that was part of it. I just thought that was a reflection.
Well,
you
can pile your mic. It's okay. Tommy, if you want to pile your mic.
And I thought these were going to be weird, random questions. Like, you know.
Well, the last one is. The most random fan encounter that you ever had?
Most random fan encounter. Okay. Most people remember when I was in WWE, I started doing stuff from, like, the Jackass era, and I ate the Undertaker's chew. A lot of people remember that. We did a thing where I set up a lemonade stand in the men's room of the thing, and we were feigning, because I will drink and eat anything. I do draw the line at urine, poop, and vomit, but I got to have my limits. And we set up a lemonade stand, and I was fake urinating and then handing people, you know, fake lemonade. However, all the fans started, like, hearing about this, and now we got thousands of people in the men's room, and women were in there, too, and people were really peeing during, you know, this whole thing, and I just really had to pee, so I decided to pee in about four cups, and I was peeing in the cups, and I went, and there was fans there, we had cameras, and I said, hey, guy, and I showed them, they showed me my back to the thing, and I was really peeing in the cups. And I would turn to the fans, and I'd be like, hey, I just peed and made lemonade. Do you want to drink it? They're like, okay, is this going to be on TV? And people were drinking my piss. And just to be on television. That never aired on television because the lovely producer-to-be did not get releases on them. It was actually, I believe it was in St. Louis where I did that. But I guess the random fan encounter, you never want to meet people when you're in the bathroom or... When I guess my favorite or least favorite place, I go shopping with my wife once a week, and I return all my bottles. I like to get my 5-10 cents. It also kills some time for me to start, you know, recycling. And then I'll be throwing in my cans, you know, my plastics, and waiting for my little slip. And people are like, excuse me, are you Tommy Dreamer? I'm like, yes, I am, as I'm waiting for my 5-cent refund thing to so I usually get noticed there amongst all the canned people. And there's a lot of them, and I hate the smell of that room. All that dried up soda and beer is gross. It reminds me of tagging with the Sandman.
Well, one last question for me here. Can you talk to me about, you know, you said you worked in the WWE office. About the office, I heard there was like a merchandise room and also like a warehouse where all the caskets and all the different props are. Is there truth to that? Are there like really like a merchandise room?
There is now, correct. There used to be a merchandise room. I haven't worked there in behind the scenes in a while. But, yes, there used to be a merchandise room. I used to kind of also be like the tour guide because I was the only real wrestler that worked there. And, you know, you take people on tours and then you wind up in the, you know, and we'd, you know, give people action figures, all that stuff. But now, yes, they do have an actual physical warehouse. They used to have a tracks training facility there, too, and they would have a ring. And, you know, that's their WWE is a huge corporation. But, yes, that is true. Joey Styles, I think, hosts something on WWE.com about the warehouse. And, I have been to a warehouse. I don't know if it's the same warehouse, but, yeah, man, they had everything. They had all the sets. They had... You name it, they had it. I remember they had the big chair
that, you know, the for the King of Ring, where the guys would walk the wrestlers to the to, on their shoulders, and they had that there. I remember seeing all this stuff there. But, yes, that is true.
Guys, come on out and check out Tommy Dreamer at the House of Hardcore this upcoming week, this weekend, Poughkeepsie, New York, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Tommy, thanks for taking some time with us tonight.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for everyone who's supported me throughout the years. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tommy.
Thanks.
Take care, guys.
For Mike Tremontazzi, I'm Randy Zellia. We'll see you next week, Real Sports Talk Radio. Keep in contact with us. We'll figure out who next week's guests are, and you guys will be the first ones to know. Good night, everyone.